Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. The Ohio House is expected to pass a Stand Your Ground bill this week. That would end the requirement to retreat before using deadly force in self-defense. And it blocks local governments as well from passing gun control laws. Governor John Kasich has said that he'd veto the bill if it gets to his desk. But House Speaker Ryan Smith said Republicans have the votes to override a veto. Joining us now, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning.
Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel, welcome back.
Good morning.
And for the last time, I weep. Cincinnati Enquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson. Welcome back for the last time you're leaving.
I am, yeah. My husband and I are moving to Spokane, Washington in 2 weeks from today, actually.
And you're going to become an editor for USA Today.
That's what they tell me, although things are always a little in flux at USA Today, okay. But I will be working for them in some capacity, likely as an editor, yes.
Well, best wishes for every success. We'll miss you.
Thank you. Thanks. I just love Central Ohio and kind of hoped we would stay here forever, but things change sometimes. Yeah. My husband's going
to
be a professor at Gonzaga, so just keep following the physicist wherever he goes, you know?
There you go. Well, thanks for joining us for all these years now.
Thank you. I really loved it. This show is always fun for me.
So what a great way to kick off the week, right?
It's really depressing. Let's talk politics.
So,
yay.
The Stand Your Ground bill. Why is this a priority for the Ohio General Assembly? Jim Siegel?
Well, Anne, you really never have to ask why a gun bill is a priority for this General Assembly.
Well, I guess in light of parkland, in light of where we're at right now.
In light of anything. It doesn't matter.
It just doesn't matter. It's part of a long line of gun restrictions or gun easements.
Yes, they are going to continue to roll back gun restrictions as long as they control things. The Republicans, I mean. They don't need a reason. And the prosecutors will tell you there's no reason at all to pass this bill. But they are moving ahead with it, and at least that's the indication they gave last week. And the bill that Governor Kasich has advocated for, some things like red flag law, which allows you to remove guns from folks who a judge decides are a danger to themselves or others, that bill is much less likely to move, at least in the form it's in now.
The governor has threatened to veto the Stand Your Ground bill if it reaches his desk, and the speaker said they have the votes to override a veto. Is that a sure thing?
I don't know. Vetoes are never a sure thing because there's always more at play than just whether or not you support the bill.
Uh-huh.
And because you're now going up against your governor, and frankly, when you're talking about a veto, we're also talking about an override, getting enough members to show up.
They're saying they do, but I wonder.
They may not actually have the members available to do it until after the election, because getting 99 members to come to a summer session is difficult to do, and so they may just have a hard time rounding up enough folks before then.
Well, it's supposed to go to the Senate, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we don't have time.
We don't have a law here.
Well, yeah, not until after the election.
Right.
But, if you look
during
at the last—
during the lame duck session,
right,
by the way, yeah.
Right, when everything else gets passed. When you look at the last couple sessions, you look at this, what we've had largely the, supermajority Republican House and Senate. It seems that at the end of each two-year session, they pass a gun bill.
And it's
usually picking up from— a dozen other bills that have been introduced over that session, and they're kind of rolled into one. So, new Speaker Smith, said that there's a lot of support among House Republicans for this Stand Your Ground language. If it's not in this bill, it might end up in another bill, a different vehicle, and be passed.
We're talking about Stand Your Ground legislation. It's pending in the Ohio House. The governor has threatened to veto it. It still hasn't gone through the Senate yet. There's lots of time. You just heard from Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Also with us, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch and Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Enquirer. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Chrissy Thompson, the measure also includes, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but a provision that would ban local ordinances restricting gun usage.
If this goes to the bump stacks.
Still in there? Yeah,
right.
I think it's still in there. Yeah. So, you know, there's been some back and forths, like Cincinnati has banned bump stocks.
Columbus has banned bump stocks. Yeah.
Right. And we saw this play out several years ago with Cleveland and their assault weapons ban. And, you know, Ohio has several laws on the books saying that basically, you know, the state legislature says something and you pass a law in your little municipality that's against that, that there can, you know, that the state legislature is, it trumps you. But none of these things matter unless there's suits that are filed, right? Mm-hmm. So
there's a lawsuit that's been filed.
Right. So then it plays out in court and we'll see who wins. But generally speaking, as we saw in Cleveland, I mean, municipalities are not going to win this one. So.
Municipalities aren't winning any of them. It is Ohio is known as a local control state, but I'm just not feeling it anymore. And ironically, local control is something that Republicans embrace as a doctrine.
Well, I've said it for many years, and I'll just say it again. Politicians are all for local control right up until they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically means that right up until the point that local governments start doing something they don't like, and then they take that ability away from them. And it's been done on a number of different issues, guns being the most perhaps the most prominent.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, everyone likes to talk local government, but they don't like when local government intrudes on a special interest that has some push around the state house.
You know, and these aren't just any local governments. They tend to be the local governments from the biggest municipalities in the state. Right, Jackie?
Yeah. These are, you know, urban governments, which typically have Democratic leaders. I mean, look at, you know, Columbus, Cincinnati, Cleveland, three cities that have said we want to be able to pass some laws, some local laws so that we can enforce, you know, some of these things. Some of them are, you know, like bump stocks, things that are pretty, you know, public opinion would say, you know, we don't really need bump stocks.
Which increases the amount of rounds that you can.
It increases the rate of fire.
Yeah.
It can. It turns a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon.
And a very inaccurate automatic weapon. But
you
so,
could spray bullets.
So,
and
yeah,
stuff.
But
yeah.
You can spray bullets into a crowd,
increases,
as was done in Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas, right. Correct. Yeah. So remember that supposedly this is going to be regulated by the federal government. And so that is what some Republicans say is you don't even need to pass these. It's going to be regulated by the Trump administration. But those same people will also email us when we write stories about it saying, like, hasn't happened yet, hasn't happened yet, hasn't still legal, hasn't happened yet. So,
yes. And as I say, with local control, these are also the same folks who say we don't want federal interference.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Right up until it makes it so that we won't pass our own, you know, restrictions.
I think the
and then we embrace federal interference.
And then all of a sudden, that's what we point to is for
state
why we're not acting.
Favorite kind of local control
that's
is
what they have traditionally, but
it's their favorite kind is the kind where your local government pays for something that the state
right.
doesn't have to pay for.
Right.
That is what they mean by
that's
local control.
Another big change.
This
over
is
the last
your
15
problem.
To 20
you
years.
Fix it. Yeah. That is often what they mean.
I didn't pass that tax increase. That right. was a local tax.
We
increase.
Think the local officials would know better how to spend the money. So they should.
Yeah. I mean, the argument against local gun ordinances is, you know, are they effective and do they work? You know, if you ban bump stocks in Cleveland, what's not to say that you're just going to go to Akron and buy your bump stock and bring it back to Cleveland. With this, and there, like we just said, there is already a law that really restricts locals from being able to pass gun ordinances. And this bill just really tightens it up. So like Columbus and Cincinnati have said that they feel comfortable passing the legislation that they've passed because they feel like it kind of fills in, it kind of fits in between the gaps in the current law. But House Bill 228 would really tighten that up so to prevent any sort of restrictions.
Yeah, I mean, there are some legit arguments for why you don't want every city to have, you know, very different gun laws. Because if you're
argument,
yeah, and if you're a legitimate, you know, legal gun carrying concealed carry permit holder. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to have to worry about accidentally breaking a local law because you happen to be carrying a gun somewhere that you were able to carry it in, you know, several other places in Ohio.
Drive through a corner of the county.
There's definitely reasons why the state would want to do some limiting of that, but at the same time, like the stuff Columbus has talked about doing, banning bump stocks. I mean, there is a point, of course, where you go and you're just outright, you know, taking away all local power to protect their citizens as they see fit, and you're simply saying that you shall not do anything that we deem to be improper.
Let's just say that this legislation doesn't have the votes or the time to pass before they recess for summer, or they can't get enough votes to override a veto and therefore won't want to move forward on it until they do. What other bits and pieces of legislation could be tapped on it? Could this be something bigger by the time the lame duck session rolls around? More gun restrictions eased, more gun, pro-gun measures tagged onto it.
You could see something about schools, I guess. I think it's unlikely, but you could.
About school security?
Carrying in schools. At least easing restrictions if it happens that you are in a school and you need to fire your gun and you happen to have it and they, you know, type of a thing. That there are bills like that out there. I think it's unlikely, but that's something you could see. I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Well, like Jackie mentioned earlier, these bills tend to get cobbled together, especially in lame duck session. Lame duck session is the session after the election when there's a great number of members who either never have to be on the ballot again or are heading out the door, period, at the end of the year. So there's a lot less pressure on them to do things. So they tend to be more free with their votes, and a lot of crazy bills sometimes pass. But yeah, so anything could occur. And also pay attention to who gets elected governor. Not that Rich Cordray is anti-gun necessarily, but there could be some who want to pass some of these measures. If Rich Cordray were elected, they would want to get them in place beforehand. Although, to some respect, to Rich Cordray, I'm not sure, but he may be less willing or more willing to sign some bills that maybe even John Kasich wouldn't do.
But his opponent, Mike DeWine, the Republican, probably not.
I mean, like, I think at their core, I just think, like, as if they're just human beings, I think that Mike DeWine and Rich Cordray actually probably have many of the same views on guns. I mean, DeWine is the one that had the worst. The last time they were ranked at the same time by the NRA, DeWine had the way worse rating than Cordray. He had an A-plus rating, Cordray did. So Cordray has mellowed a little bit, but he does not support a assault weapons ban, for instance. DeWine, for what it's worth, is not, said a whole lot about that one way or another either, and did support restrictions like that when he was in Congress. So I think probably they actually, if you were just to tell them, like, at the end of their lives, what do you really think about guns, they probably would have similar opinions. That's my personal thought. But
we will continue our conversation about what's going on down at the State House, what's going on in state government and politics. So stay with us. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Still with us, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel, and Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Christy Thompson. We have been talking about gun legislation. I think we should move on to something that happened in the last few days, and that is a telephone conversation. It was a group interview or a I don't know what, with Ohio GOP chairwoman Jane Timken. Darryl Rowland wrote about it for the Dispatch yesterday. Jackie Borchardt, you were on that call. What happened?
I was on the call. So the call was billed as a chance for reporters to hear from Jane Timken, the GOP, Ohio GOP chairwoman, Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, who, you know, lost in a bitter primary battle for the Republican gubernatorial nomination, and Pat McDonald, who is the director of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections. And they were, you know, we got on the call and each of them spoke a little bit about each of the down ticket races. So auditor, secretary of state, attorney general, treasurer, and why the Republican candidates were better than the Democratic candidates. And they each spoke, you know, from prepared remarks. And then at the end, after about 20 minutes, I would say, the communications person for the party said that they would start taking questions, but they would not be answering any questions other than ones that were focused on those down ticket races. And this was at like almost, you know, 4:35 o'clock, pretty late in the day.
Thursday.
Thursday, but still pretty late in the day,
yeah.
Which on our timetable isn't really a lot of time to put together anything thorough or thoughtful. And really what they were saying in the prepared remarks was not really anything new to reporters who have been following these races. Mm-hmm. It was kind of, you know,
it was a dog and pony show kind of a.
I just expected that, and that happens sometimes when you get a call or a press conference, and they're just kind of going over bullet points or, you know, like a mini stump speech almost, mm-hmm. for each candidate. And then the real show is in the questions, because that's your opportunity to either challenge them on things they've said or, you know, in many cases, ask about other things that you've been working that are important to, mm-hmm. to your readers. So when we got to the question and answer portion, they said they would not be entertaining any questions that weren't about the down ticket races. And there was kind of a awkward pause. And the dispatcher's Randy Ludlow said, well, I object to that because, you know, that's just not how typically how these things run.
And you didn't bill it that way.
And it was billed as a phone call about the down ticket races, but it didn't say no questions would be entertained. And just by a comparison, you know, when Governor Kasich holds an event, you know, usually the press, his press shop will tell us whether or not the governor has time for questions. Usually, if he's got to, you know, run to something else or he's not going to be taking questions, that's one
but
thing.
But if he has time for questions,
but if he has time for questions, right?
The journalist.
This is something that every once in a while we get this from brand new people running for the very bottom, mm-hmm. like treasurer or something. We'll be like, well, why did you ask me a question that wasn't about my event? Well, the reason that we come and we listen to what you have to say, and then we ask our own questions about whatever we want to, and that's how it always works.
Called access.
Yeah, that's how it always works. And if you don't want to answer tough questions, you can, first of all, you can just say, I decline to comment. I'm going to leave now. And that happens sometimes. Or you can just not have an event with reporters. So, you know.
But you can't dictate what they ask.
No, absolutely right. Not. And this is the way we all operate. I think maybe not everyone who's listening understands that, but that is how that's how you break news, is you go and you ask questions that aren't related to the prepared stuff that's how you do it.
Right.
So.
Well, and after, you know, Randy made his objection clear, they asked again for any questions and
awkward silence.
No one had any questions.
Well, and of course, from the outside, the question is, why wouldn't you take questions? Right. What are you afraid to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're the Republican Party chair.
You're in control.
You've
of
got
everything.
The lieutenant governor sitting there with you. What are you afraid to? What questions are you afraid of? And that doesn't, to be honest, that really does not speak well for the way things are going for the Republicans right now.
Jane Timken is not very accessible in the first place,
no,
right?
She's not.
Right, and I'll just take it a step further. You can make assumptions about what kind of questions they weren't willing to take. For instance, you know, after the call, both, I guess, the dispatch and then also the Inquirer contacted Mary Taylor and her spokesman and said, are you going to vote for Mike DeWine, who you railed against during the primary, who is the party's nominee? And she released a statement saying that she would vote for the ticket and did not use his name. So there, she also, you know, went to war with Jane Timken over the fact that the party endorsed Mike DeWine. Mm. They obviously don't want to talk about that. you know,
that would have been my first question.
Yeah. Like, that was my,
you two are sitting here next to each other on the phone. You guys were tearing each other apart 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, I mean, Mary Taylor said some things about the party. I thought, well, she's done ending her political career.
What do you think the purpose was then, Jackie? What was the point of the whole thing?
Well, I think the point was they wanted to get their message across that, you know, about their down ticket candidates. But look, I mean, it's June. We're still in session at the state house.
This is not top priority.
And no. To me, it was a little odd in the timing in that it wasn't like the Democrats had a similar event or there had been some big, you know, maybe down ticket news that kind of shook things up. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I looked at the notice and saw, OK, Jane Timken's going to be on this call. Mary Taylor's going to be on this call. This is a great Pat McDonald, to his credit, always returns my phone calls. So I'm getting him out of this. But
the Republican Party.
Right. But you know, to see again, that was my question that, you know, those two are on this call together. This is a great opportunity to find out where they are.
And look, the Ohio Republican Party chair telling people that the Republican candidates are better is not news. Mm-hmm. That is not news. That right. is why the That's reporters wanted to ask other questions. It's not news that you think everyone should vote for the
but
Republican
now it's
down tickets.
News because of their refusal to answer questions.
Right. It became a different story.
Right.
There is a chance that they thought, like Jackie said, that they wanted to get their message out. There's a chance. I mean, basically, polls have shown on the governor's side that the race is very competitive, Republicans and Democrats. And given the situation in the White House right now and public opinion about that, it is very likely that the down ticket races are also competitive. So there is a chance that they wanted to try to get some positive stuff in what they call earned media in the paper on the internet about their down ticket candidates. But one would assume that they put this together to try to show unity and then to decline to take questions about it. Well, I mean, it's clear that they were not ready to do this if they're not going to take questions about it and they're not going to talk about the candidate who Mary Taylor ran against, the, you know, candidate for governor, Mike DeWine.
Let's get some perspective here. By the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. It's Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Matt Borges, the previous GOP chair, how did he run these kinds of things?
Matt Borges would take questions on the call,
anywhere,
after the call, via text.
He was very accessible.
And, I mean, I got to watch a GOP debate with him. The regular debate. And in which his wife told me that she hated Hillary Clinton and his dog threw up everywhere.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
that.
He was that, – that's accessibility.
Yeah. Okay.
He was the extreme. He would go off on Donald Trump anytime anyone local or national called him. So that's an extreme case in a positive way for us. But, you know, one could argue maybe.
I think, you know, every party leader has kind of their own style.
Sure.
And, you know, some certainly probably prefer to be more behind the scenes. But as far as, you know, our needs as reporters, as far as being able to ask questions, I mean, it's really not comparable between
the
two of them.
What about her Democratic counterpart, David Pepper?
As far as accessibility?
Yeah.
Very accessible.
Yeah, he's very accessible.
Okay. So coming up this week, this is the last week before they go on summer break, right? Fingers crossed.
At the State House, yeah.
Usually they would have been done by now.
They've got elections to win. I don't know what they're still doing
around the
State House.
It's not like they have a budget bill
or
anything like that.
Jackie.
Usually they go right up to the end of the month with a budget bill, but on an off year.
Usually in an off year, they're done by the second week of June
because they got a campaign.
The expectation was that they were going to be done at the end of May. I mean, they should have been done a month ago when the speaker resigns under the FBI investigation and throws the whole House into chaos. Well, that tends to throw off your timeline. And here we are.
By 7 weeks in this case.
Yeah, by 7 weeks. And so here we are at the end of June trying to pass a whole host of bills under a largely artificial deadline. And we'll see what they manage to push through.
What now, Jackie, you've written about puppy mill legislation. Ohio is one of the most liberal four puppy mills in the country, or one of the top two. What are they looking at restricting?
Well, so there was a ballot issue circulating. Probably ran into people asking for your signature on and outside grocery stores and events and such, that would basically establish some standards of care for high volume dog breeders. So these are, you know, these are people who are breeding dogs for the purpose of selling them and making a living. And Ohio did not really have – it did have a law a couple years ago, back in 2013, I believe. We did pass a law that allows the Ohio Department of Agriculture to inspect and license high-volume breeders. Animal advocates said that the bar for who would be licensed and regulated was a little too high. So what this bill does, House Bill 506, is it lowers that threshold a little bit so that it'll hopefully – include more breeders, as many as 800 to 1,000 by some estimates within the state. And Ohio is a pretty it's a big business in Ohio. Missouri is the other state that produces a lot of these dogs. But what this bill does is it establishes some really basic standards of care, like stuff that would be no brainer to anyone that owns a dog, like feeding them twice a day, access to potable water all day long, 30 minutes of exercise, at least, you know, setting some minimums. If there's a medical issue, prompt veterinary care. You can't stack cages. That's that won't go into effect until for a couple of years. But that's a big deal. You can't have, you know, wire cage. The cages can't be wire on the bottom because that hurts the dog's paws. They have to be a certain size relative to the dog's size so that you can't just, you know, so that they can be able to move around and lay down and, you know, stuff like that. That seems kind of like a no-brainer, but it wasn't in place before. And, you know, what's interesting about this bill is it got everybody – all the stakeholders, everyone involved in it kind of agreed to support it. And there was kind of a gentleman's agreement reached among the breeders and the Veterinary Association and these animal rights advocates, pet store folks, that they won't water down this legislation in the future in exchange for the animal rights advocates pledging not to return to the ballot for 10 years. So it's being called a win-win by pretty much everybody involved. Obviously the people who are violating this law probably don't think it's a win, but...
It looks like it's going to pass?
It's passed. It's okay. On its way to Kasich.
Gotcha. Okay.
So,
okay.
And I think, you know, given the volume of support from everyone involved, and it had bipartisan support, almost near unanimous support, I think there was one holdout in the Senate, and I think six in the House that voted against it. Kasich's expected to sign it. So, I mean, it's a big deal.
Where does that put Ohio then among the states when it comes to puppy mill restrictions?
Well, you know, the advocates and the breeders say that it will make Ohio one of the most progressive in terms of providing good standards for dogs. And actually, there's some hope among the pet store folks and the Humane Society, which backed this measure, was backing the ballot measure, that this will become a model for other states and hopefully the federal government, because the U.S. Department of Agriculture is supposed to – they have jurisdiction over this area, and the national standards are not nearly as good as Ohio's new standards.
Proposed new standards.
Yeah.
And what about enforcement? Because a lot of times there's no teeth and stuff like this. It's like, oh, that's a law, but yeah. Who's going to be out there inspecting?
Well, the Department of Agriculture is, and they take it very seriously. They have since the 2013 law. And it's a – these are civil infractions when you – for not following this. So it would be, you know, licensing and inspecting. Of course, anything that veers into animal cruelty in Ohio's animal cruelty
is a
laws
criminal.
Is a criminal offense.
Yeah.
And local law enforcement would take care of that. And those laws have gotten better in the last couple of years as well. Hmm. But, you know, there is also something in this bill where pet stores have to – there's an incentive for pet stores to get their dogs from reputable breeders that follow these standards. The way they do it is they have to require the breeder to sign off on a form saying that they are adhering to Ohio's law and rules and regulations in this area. So that's hopefully one area where it will, you know, that will help aid compliance with the law.
If this, as far as putting something on the ballot, it's being called a win-win. So the people that are pushing for this legislation, they're satisfied that this is going to do the trick finally.
Yeah, they say they got about 95% of what they wanted. And if you look at their proposed measure, which would have been a constitutional amendment, would have been in the Constitution, which is, you know, for lawmakers, that's their number one incentive to get ahead of the issue because they don't want this kind of language in their in the Constitution. Because it's extremely hard to change. So if you compare that language to the actual bill that was passed, there's a lot of similarities, a lot of things in common. Even some of the same language was adopted.
Okay.
And just remember that Ohio, the reason that we did not have progressive puppy mill laws is because largely because of the lobbying of Petco, which is based in Chillicothe.
Mm-hmm.
So that.
And they've backed off.
Petland?
Or Petland.
Oh, my mistake. Petland. My mistake, everyone. Petland.
Not Petco, Petland.
I apologize.
Okay.
Petland, yes, which is based in Chillicothe. And I'm out of here. No.
Yeah, Petland does support
this.
This
is her
bill.
Last day.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, there was Petland, and then for years there was also the Amish community
right.
was very big on and fighting against any regulation
and
because
they
do a lot of dog breeding. And you know, and there's just a number of farmer, you know, agricultural areas where this has become a prevalent thing, and it was just hard to get it past some of your rural lawmakers who were fighting against it.
To representing their constituents.
Yeah. So, but again, we, you know, they put up a ballot issue and something got, you know, used it as leverage and mm-hmm. they got something passed that appears to be a good thing if you're a dog.
If you're pro puppy.
If you're a dog. Or if you're buying a dog from a pet store. I mean,
you will know that it
that's,
wasn't.
That's true. This enables you to, you know,
have more
you,
confidence.
You could to take your kid to the pet store and feel better about buying from a from Petland.
And in another bill, though, passed last week, the Ohio's official pet is now the shelter pet. So
oh.
So we've got support
the,
for
the trilobite
the breeders
the official,
and support
yeah.
for.
I'm sure parents are looking that up before they go and buy their. What is the official pet?
You never know. It gave them something to do.
Well, there was another bill that had the lab as the official state dog, right? Wasn't it the.
And,
really? Labrador, yeah, that got a couple. That got several hearings, but I don't know. That
yeah, no, I recall this. Yes,
oh my
someone
god,
someone who owns a lab decided to do this.
Yeah,
right.
The yeah, official state course, this, yeah. the official state that. It's the cardinal, the state flower. Come on, help me out.
I didn't grow.
Oh, the architectural structure also in the bill last week is the barn.
Is that the official
not,
state?
Not the covered bridge, but the barn.
That's important.
Well, agriculture is the number one industry in the state of Ohio, just saying. We will be right back on our weekly reporter roundtable, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel, and Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson. Ohio Republicans, how have they responded to the Trump administration's policy to separate children from their parents at the border when they enter the United States illegally? Is this become an issue at the State House? Is this something that you'd ask candidates for public office in Ohio? Jim Siegel?
Well, you definitely would ask the federal candidates, congressional and the Senate candidates.
Well, the governor's candidates, though, they would be in a position to send National Guard troops to reinforce them.
I can't even remember. I haven't really written about it, but Cordray's opposed, obviously, to it pretty strongly. Mm-hmm. DeWine has been a lot softer on it, from what I understand. He sort of said he doesn't like it, but didn't call for anything specific to occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I wasn't there either, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Yeah, it wasn't calling for him to end the program, wasn't calling for any legislation to change it. He was,
someone gave him an opportunity, I think. They said, well, will you such and such about President Trump? And he declined to comment. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
He had their annual, or I guess it's an annual thing, their picnic or what do they call it?
Ice
cream social, that's right. I've never been to one, even after all these years. It just, Randy Ludlow from the Dispatch went this year. Anybody from the Inquirer or the, no? He looked like he was having fun. That is Mike DeWine. I don't know about Randy. but no, not much news comes out of these kinds of events, right?
Well, last year he announced that he was running.
Okay.
It wasn't necessarily news in that I think everyone reported before that he was going to actually announce it at the ice cream social. This year, I think if you're just a regular person going to this, or a voter, even a Republican voter, it's an opportunity to bump elbows with the Republican ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Portman was there. John Husted, Frank LaRose, Keith Faber, Dave Yost, Jim Renacci was not there.
He was the Republican
running for Senate.
Right? Why do you think?
Well, in the last, I think it was just last, it's hard for me to keep track of time with some of this stuff. last week, my colleague Seth Richardson up in Cleveland wrote about how, Renacci was running for governor up until earlier this year when Josh Mandel stepped out of the Senate race. And he said some, not very nice things about Mike DeWine and Mary Taylor and John Husted. And now, Mike DeWine and John Husted are running at the top of the ticket that he is going to be sharing with them.
Right.
He had some ads calling them, I think, the corrupt Columbus politicians. There was a whole thread of that.
It's definitely too easy to walk
back.
Yeah,
and, his campaign made some kind of unfortunate comments that were recycled again last week with this story that it be. Actually, it was my colleague Andrew Tobias who wrote about this, that, maybe that might come back to haunt him. The campaign said, both campaigns, DeWine and Renacci, said that's not true. They endorse each other. They support each other. They sent a picture of the two of them at an event to kind of prove that they are together.
Hmm.
So
okay. And Fran, DeWine's pies are really good.
I personally think maybe you don't want to agree with me. I am. Moving, as we have already said. But I think that there's nothing, unless I guess you're just a Democrat and you don't want to be around Republicans, there's nothing not to like about the ice cream social. Mm-hmm. They open up their family estate, which is really cool.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. She really does.
She and her family make pies.
And, they give everyone ice cream. And
there's three-legged races.
I think it sounds fun.
Old-fashioned.
If you're a Democrat, they're going to let you in and let you play. I think it sounds like a fun thing. It is on a Saturday, and for us, that's work. And so, no, I've never been. But it sounds like a positive thing for Ohio.
Yeah. It's been going on for a long time. As long as I've been, for at least 30 years. So.
Yeah, I've always had a conflict, so I haven't been able to go. But, it's really cool that this is one of the times where they open up the property to the public. It's a historic site. It was the childhood home of Whitelaw Reed, who was a Civil War Ohio journalist. And I think he ran for vice president as well. So it's a really beautiful house.
It has been a few weeks since I brought up ECOT. There is legislation that would further restrict or better regulate for-profit charter schools in the state of Ohio. Does this any chance, Jim Siegel, of moving with this?
Yes, I think so. At least parts of it. There was a full bill introduced, but it appears that what they're going to do is likely break that bill up into some pieces and stick it into other bills that are nearly completed. And by that I mean a House bill that's in the Senate or a Senate bill that's in the House, that it wouldn't take much to amend it and get it done this week. That's what I understand is going to happen. I don't know exactly what all the details are in terms of what exactly is going to get amended in, but but yeah, they're going to do some things like I believe study the actual way we fund e-schools and count enrollment. Okay. That's of course been at the heart of the problem with ECOT, in that they couldn't verify their own enrollment, and therefore the state said, "Well, you don't deserve $80 million for the last 2 years." There's an issue about you don't have to withdraw a student until they've had 105 consecutive unexcused hours of absence. Now, if you do the math, that's 21 days. So you don't have to show up for school for basically an entire month at an e-school. Don't have to log in. Don't have to do anything. And then on the first day of the next month, if you log in for 10 minutes, you are good, and you will remain on the rolls, and you will
and then the clock starts over.
The clock starts over, and they will try to count you as a full time student for payment purposes. Again, a lot of this goes back to how much are we paying the e-schools, and so there's issues like that, attempting to do some clarification, I think, of what exactly are the e-schools expected to provide the state in terms of data to verify their enrollment counts, and what should the state be asking for, and do they have the people there to actually analyze it and do the investigation? That's also been a problem.
At the Department of Education?
Yeah, that's also been a problem. I mean, the folks who have been doing these attendance audits, they just are not trained to do the kind of data analysis work that they were suddenly asked to do. So yeah, I think they're going to get around to doing a number of these provisions this week. The big question, of course, is why weren't we talking about this in June 2017? Mm-hmm. Why is it June 2018 and we're doing all this? Mm-hmm. This should have been done a year ago.
Because it was June 2016 when the issue first really.
Right. That's to me, that's the big question, is why did it take so long to get around to doing some of this?
Hmm. Is this going to be an issue that dogs the likes of, let's say, Dave Yost, who's running for attorney general? He's been state auditor. He is also a big supporter of ECOT until the last year or so.
I think it will be a campaign issue for sure. And it's certainly something the Democrats are trying to hammer home to voters. I don't know how well it's going to stick with voters.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. It has to be messaged correctly And honestly, there has to be a lot of upfront work to be able to get it to be something someone would vote on.
Well, and, we haven't had, indictments. We haven't had convictions. We've had some audits. We've had, quite a few news stories in the Columbus paper. I think maybe within Columbus, it probably has a little bit more attention. I don't know, though, that reaches up to Toledo or, to Zanesville.
Right. And I mean, Auditor Yost did do an audit. He forwarded along recommendations for charges to be filed against ECOT officials for fraud. And we're still waiting to hear if Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien or if the U.S. attorney is going to act on those and exactly what they plan to do. We're aware the FBI is also investigating ECOT contributions to Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And whether or not they were allowed to use that money done that.
Yeah, whether or not these, especially a lot of the folks who, Bill Lager, of course, is the founder of ECOT and has all the money. The problem is when his associates start donating $70,000 at a time, then that perks up the ears of everybody.
Yeah.
Except apparently maybe the folks getting the money because they didn't seem to mind. But but the everyone else was like, wait a second, when did this person suddenly get the ability to donate that much money at once? Well, the question is, weren't they getting improperly reimbursed on the back end, which is illegal? Mm-hmm. There's some questions being raised there. And so a lot of it, too, is, the timing of this. The Supreme Court any time now will rule in the ECOT case. and tell us once and for all whether they were whether the state acted legally when it required this new documentation for the enrollment. No one I know thinks that ECOT's going to win, but you know.
And you're
I never
saying
know.
any time now the Supreme Court. I mean, there's not much time left on. They take a break too in the summer, don't they?
Yeah, I mean they could they could issue it in December. I mean, there's nothing right? I mean, there's nothing that.
No, but the expectation is they'll do it. They'll do it sooner rather than later,
particularly
when the new school year is going to start up.
Yeah,
I
mean, exactly.
I think they want to get it and get that out there simply for practical purposes for everyone to say, okay, the court has finally ruled on this. Now we can all move on knowing what we know.
Right, but there's no requirement for them to do it now, as opposed to a couple months from now.
Okay, so what else are you guys going to be looking for this week coming up? We have about 3 minutes left. It's all the time in the world.
I think the big question mark for this week is the payday loan restrictions. The Senate now has the ball, and they are working, feverishly, furiously to try to get some sort of a compromise.
Will they be watered down? That's the question.
Watered down, meaning from 123. I don't think we'll see 123 pass the Senate.
Right.
As long as the payday lenders are saying this would, close our doors and put us out of business, I don't think that's going to pass, even though that was what was largely in the 2008 law.
It would, by the way, limit, what is it, to 28%?
Right. The annual percentage rate is kind of, that's the probably the biggest sticking point.
Yeah. So the senators are working on something that the payday lending industry says that they can get behind. And it would increase the annual, it would allow the annual percentage rate to be up to 300%. It's currently in the 300. It's currently in the 500s.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
So in practice. Mm-hmm. So, if you view that being watered down, then yeah, as Jackie said, it's not going to pass as is. So the question is whether the House, which is really the one, the chamber that has, an FBI investigation sort of related to this bill going on there, and was so eager to pass something really strict to show that the people who are left were not involved in that. So the question is whether they
even
would.
Though that the bill had languished, the legislation had languished for months and months and months. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of who are the stakeholders here. Obviously, the payday lending industry. Oh, there were threats of putting something on the ballot in that regard. How are those folks responding?
Well, they're saying they're going to go forward if they don't pass a strong bill. And that, again, we were talking earlier about the puppy mills.
Mill, yeah.
This is once again another issue where lawmakers are staring down a constitutional amendment on payday lending if they don't act in a way that this coalition of consumer advocates and religious groups and business groups thinks that
and voters
is
have
proper.
Spoken on
I
this issue
say,
before.
Like puppy mills, both of these are issues that I think would win big at the ballot box if they get there.
Right.
I mean, if payday lending goes to the ballot again, like you saw in 2008, you're going to see millions of dollars being spent by these companies to try to, keep things the way they are. And that happened in 2008 and they still lost by a big margin. Mm-hmm. So, it's an issue. Same thing like with medical marijuana. It's an issue where the public opinion is very firmly in one side of things.
And the consumer advocates are concerned about what the Senate's talking about doing because it takes things out of the bill like an issue that would say you only have to repay your repayment plan. You only have to repay 5% of your income per month. I mean, so it makes sure that it's affordable and it makes sure that the loan is not more, or that the interest is not more than 50% of the loan amount. It's things like that they say really help consumers that would be stripped out and replaced by things that don't really help consumers that much, like limits on how many loans you can take out.
We'll keep an eye on that. Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Bureau Chief of the Cincinnati Choir, for a few more days. Thank you so much for joining us and best wishes for every success in Washington State.
Thank you, Ann. Keep in touch.
We will. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.